mission to follow in the footsteps of this great human being.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
He was a teacher.
On December 12, 1925, in a totally undemocratic move, Mr. Reza Pahlavi is appointed the king of Iran. During these days, when the world is taking a fresh breath of temporary peace after World War I, Reza Khan Mirpanch sets his sights on creating fundamental changes in Iran. Different tasks, including the construction of a nationwide railway system, banning all Islamic veils, the establishment of Iran's first civil laws and other such activities, the founding of a modern education system, is among the first orders of Iran's king, who wears a military uniform. Only a few months after the coronation of the new Shah of Iran, the government is tasked with the development and expansion of education at the elementary level. Old schools under the supervision of clerics are shut down and replaced with schools with teachers who are not clerics and follow the guidelines of Reza Shah's Ministry of Culture. With the establishment of a general office of writing, drafting educational books for elementary students begin. The Shah's goal from this action is to unify school books and have direct supervision on what students are being taught at schools across the country. This supervision can be defined in one thing: nationalism and love of the Shah must be included in all school books. In early 1951, when Reza Shah's reign has come to an end and Mohammad Reza Pahlavi replaces his father on the throne, the English teacher at the biggest school in Qom, which is known as the second Dar ul Funun, is a young, well-dressed cleric who wears sunglasses, and people point him out in the streets and say that he can speak a foreign language. Sayyid Muhammad Hosseini Beheshti was born in Isfahan. He was a seminary student at the Qom Seminary School and a university student at Tehran's college. He was talented and an elite student. He chose teaching to make a living. He is not financially well off, but he is very different with the rest of the seminary students. He doesn't charge anyone tuition, writes his daily schedule on a piece of paper, and hangs it up on the wall in his room. His appointments, when to chat with friends, he's even defined joking for himself. When he becomes a top student during his BA course, they propose that he either stay in Tehran and take on an official job or become a teacher in the education system. He chooses teaching and Qom. Because of his command of the English language, the education system accepts him as a teacher at Qom's Hakim Nizami High School. In his memoirs, he writes, "The beginning of my political activities based on Islamic motivations is related to the year 1950, when Ahmad Qavam made his famous bullish speech, and I heard it on the radio. I left the house instinctively. It was a very interesting feeling for me. I didn't even know which direction I was going in, but I knew I shouldn't be at home." The nationalization of the oil movement and the link between Sayyid Mohammad Hosseini Beheshti with struggles of Dr. Mossadegh and Ayatollah Kashani are the beginning days of the young teacher's life, which was full of ups and downs. From then on, his presence in many of the political gatherings in Tehran becomes serious. On August 19, 1953, with the defeat of the nationalization of the oil industry through a coup d'etat, many had lost hope. But he would say, "No matter what condition they create, we'll come up with a new plan for it. Our problem is that we do not have enough organized members, and we have to, under the cover of a cultural movement, train them." The same idea, training members, was a spark that helped establish the religious and knowledge of high school in Qom. It was the first school which was established with efforts of the son of the founder of the Qom Seminary, Ayatollah Hayri Yazdi, and the young Sayyid Mohammad Hosseini Beheshti is put in charge of it. Now, with the establishment of the religion and knowledge school, Beheshti's extremely important and serious activities begin. Everything is done under his supervision. The school becomes one of the best schools in the country very soon. Beheshti's seriousness leads to the acceptance of all the students of the school in the entrance exam who had graduated in its first year. But his main goal in this school is training people who will play important roles in movements in the country. The entrance exam shouldn't be a preventive barrier when it comes to the students educated at this school. It's the mid-50s and Sayyid Mohammad is almost 30 and successful and well-known. His organized lifestyle helps him juggle a number of activities well and simultaneously. He studies in Allama Tabatabai's classes for 5 years, and Ayatollah Sayyid Mohammad Muhaqqiq Damad, who is strict when it comes to calling someone a mujtahid, explicitly calls him one. He also passes the Islamic philosophy doctorate exam held by Tehran University. In 1956, with the establishment of the Intelligence and Security Organization of Iran, known as SAVAK, the heavy shadow of the government casts clouds over the entire country, an organization which becomes scarier and more ghastly by the day. During these years, Beheshti comes up with a new idea: teaching modern sciences to seminary students during the night shift at the Religion and Knowledge School. He believes that seminary students must be educated like literature diploma holders and in being familiar with English, Arabic, and natural studies. This idea attracts about 30 seminary students interested in learning to the religion and knowledge school in its first term. Now everyone calls Sayyid Muhammad Dr. Beheshti, a doctor who, in addition to all the work and attention that he has in school, is well-read about Islamic economy, the banking system, and issues related to Islamic governance. He even exchanges views and ideas with seminary students and university professors. He sets up a group made up of Mr. Musavi Ardabili, Mahdavi Kani, Meshkini, Hashimi Rafsanjani, Mesbah Yazdi, and others to produce a scientific and academic research regarding Islamic governance. In March 1961, unexpected news causes grief among the people. Ayatollah Brugerdi has passed away. The death of Ayatollah Brugerdi causes all the people to take to the streets. The huge presence of the people in Ayatollah Brugerdi's funeral shows off how respected the Shia clergy are among the nation. With the death of Ayatollah Brugerdi, the atmosphere of the struggle against the Shah's regime changes and the role of the Shia clergy and seminaries become more solidified. He was in Isfahan and busy visiting his relatives when he was shocked with the news of the vicious attack of the Shah's regime to Faizia school. But he cannot remain silent and sends Imam Khomeini a telegraph from the clerics of Isfahan and condemns this attack with a gentle tone. Savak doesn't even overlook this action. He is called in and forced to make a written commitment that he will not interfere in such matters again. On October 3, 1963, Savak documents show the following comments. After the incident in Qom and the arrest of Mr. Khomeini, teachers, instructors, and students in the city of Qom encounter new provocations against the government. And one of the provocateurs is Muhammad Beheshti, who has a bachelor's degree in religious studies and teaches at the above-mentioned city's religion and knowledge school. What's obvious is that students have been provoked against the government by the aforementioned individual. These provocations have been deemed effective and tangible. Savak has officially announced that naming Ayatollah Khomeini in speeches is a crime. But Beheshti ignores Savak's announcements and at the end of all of his speeches, prays for the well-being of Ayatollah Khomeini. Finally, in the fall of 1963, Savak's worrisome reports create problems for the doctor and cause his forced transfer from Qom to Tehran. But the action may not end up to be a bad thing for him, because now in Tehran, he has a larger arena to continue his activities. With the murder of Hassan Ali Mansour by the Mutalifiz military wing, more are worried about him. His friends were sure that his name was in Savak's blacklist because of the Mutalifiz, known as the Islamic Coalition Party. They don't want this man, with so much ability, to become embroiled in a court battle and prison. He receives messages from everywhere to leave Iran any way he can. But he believes he has to stay and finish his unfinished work and research, especially now that they've exiled Ayatollah Khomeini. On the morning of March 23, 1964, Dr. Beheshti left Tehran for Kazimiya. A week later, from Iraq to Jordan, and from then on, he goes to Palestine, Syria, and Beirut. But finally, on April the 11th, he leaves Beirut for Hamburg. In Germany, he uses all of his effort in the prosperity of the mosque and the establishment of the Muslim Students' Union in Europe. The mosque grows bigger, and on March 12, 1966, the union officially begins its work. In the spring of 1970, Beheshti is getting ready to travel to Iran. He intends to return to Germany, but thinks there's the possibility that Savak will not allow it. Even though he's tried to train mosque attendees and the university students' union to be independent, he still speaks quite frankly during the last session. "Friends, when I'm gone and my trip takes long, don't ever gather around and say that when I was here, you were able to do some things. If the union is effective with the presence of a certain person, even if it's a person like me, it's best that the union does not exist at all. Your organization has to pave its way, be it with me or without me. Find replacements for forces you lose. You are the creations of the God of the world. You are human beings whose battleground is the world. Don't limit yourselves so much." The teacher comes back to Iran. During these days, the political and religious atmosphere in the country is embroiled by many problems. Just as he had guessed, he was banned from leaving the country. It had been a while that the Shah had been informed that religious school books need revisions. The tiring literature in these books, alongside the bland and difficult fiqh education, had turned this period into the most catastrophic period in schools. And the Shah orders the Minister of Education that the compilation of these books be revised. And the minister looks for people who can help with this revision. She reaches a doctor who many say is very educated and insightful. He has a vision and had spent time in Europe. And that man is none other than Sayyid Muhammad Hosseini Beheshti. The good thing about this is that Mr. Bourghei, the person in charge of the revision at the Ministry of Education, knows the doctor and wants to put together a team made up of Beheshti, Bahonar, and Golzadeh Ghafouri. The doctor likes the work and the team and accepts. Dr. Beheshti is thinking about how to properly teach the main concepts of religion to the students. He even thinks about topics regarding politics and divine leadership. He has no doubt that his cooperation with the Shah's Ministry of Education will make him infamous, but he takes the risk and enters the arena. He says, "I preferred this job to teaching as a university professor as a duty and tradition. I told friends that we will take Islamic Jihad to schools through books and pamphlets and religious studies. The Islam that's about how to live and lifestyle, not the Islam that is part of life." Beheshti set a condition for his cooperation. "My name shouldn't be printed among the authors. My nature does not allow me to have my name in a book that has photos of the Shah and his family." On March 9, 1971, the teacher starts his new work. Beheshti prepares the entirety of the lesson, and Bahonar and Golzadeh are in charge of preparing the content. At times, they ask Mr. Mutahiri for help. The prepared content gets its final approval by the group, and in the end, they give samples of the book to nearly 1,000 people so they could read them and give them their opinions. From university professors to students. The doctor does the job perfectly and with high quality. He even becomes adamant that the photos in the book are in color. The doctor believes the students must definitely see the red flag of Imam Hussein. Slowly, the books reach the students, not only millions of secondary and high school students across the country, but also their teachers become familiar with a new view and outlook of Islam. Later on, authors of the group hold seminars for teachers in different cities. Beheshti himself teaches the entire book to the teachers once. During these sessions, he's sensitive to know how religion teachers react while reading the textbook, what their opinion and criticism of the textbook is. What he does causes the training of a large number of educated individuals of this influential class. Beheshi says, "We were always worried, not out of fear that they'd arrest us and put us in prison or things like that. We were never scared of these things. We were worried that the work we were doing would be left unfinished. With God's help and relying on a well-planned method, we were successful in preparing the last of the books. Exactly after we'd sent that last book for publication, the hellish organization of the Shah found out what we'd done." On April 1, 1974, Salbach writes in one of his documents, "Beheshi's employment and sensitive but secondary positions of the Ministry of Education is not favorable because of his past political activities." This happens exactly a few days after the female minister's appreciation of Mr. Beheshi for his total seriousness and interest in Iran's school books organization. But it's too late. The books have been published, and millions of students across the country have access to them. Savak asks the Ministry of Education for explanations a number of times. But the revolutionary voices of protest can now be heard from every corner of the country. The years from 1970 to 1976 are six influential years of the presence of the teacher in the systemization of the minds of the students of Iran. Dr. Sayed Mohammad Hosseini Beheshti, born in Isfahan, a student of Qom's seminary school and a graduate of University of Tehran, known back then as Maqul and Manghul College, a talented genius and a revolutionary fighter. A cleric who's a teacher who started his struggle against Taghut from small classrooms in a school in Qom, and with effort and hard work, made it to the highest positions of influence in the Ministry of Education. And in the end, he was able to train a generation whose freedom-seeking and fighting injustice spirit was heard by the entire world, the huge revolution in Iran.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulema's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned. I believe that having only one attribute or feature of Prophet Muhammad would lead a person to a religious life. This means to act like the Prophet in life. For instance, Prophet Muhammad used to say salam when he reached the people, whether young or old. This means to imitate Prophet Muhammad in all aspects of our life. If we practice to live like Prophet Muhammad, which is of course a difficult task, then we will have a religious life. Of course, living like Prophet Muhammad is not easy. For instance, if we say salam and we hear no answer, we must not lose our hope. If we say salam and we hear no answer, the angels of Allah will answer our salams. So, to live like the Prophet is not easy, but we must do our best to have a religious life like that of Prophet Muhammad. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Let's not be naive about the symbolic importance of the U.S. putting Assange on trial. It would be an alibi for cracking down on journalism for every repressive, authoritarian government in the world, says Christian Christensen, author, in an article published under the heading "The Assange Case Still Matters a Lot." Stay tuned for more. The announcement by UK Home Secretary Priti Patel that WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange would be extradited to the US to face espionage charges may be news that many consider to be of lesser importance. We are, after all, in the midst of both a war inside of European borders and an economic crisis. The seemingly endless Assange saga has been going on for 12 years, and there is undoubtedly fatigue on the part of news consumers who have lost interest in the story. But we should be interested because this is about far more than Assange, and the stakes are very high. The reaction from international journalism and free speech organizations to the decision by the UK government, which Assange will certainly appear, has been close to uniform condemnation. Amnesty International issued a statement in which they said, allowing Julian Assange to be extradited to the US would put him at greater risk and sends a chilling message to journalists the world over. Similarly, Penn International stated that invoking the Espionage Act for practices that include receiving and publishing classified information sends a dangerous signal to journalists and publishers worldwide. Important to understand is the fact that charging Assange with espionage means that he is not able to put up what is called a public interest defense. That is, Assange cannot argue that the release of material via WikiLeaks showing, for example, U.S. war crimes in Iraq was in the public interest and thus justified. If successful, it's not hard to imagine how similar espionage charges could be used in the future against whistleblowers, journalists, and news organizations. As Trevor Tim of the Freedom of the Press Foundation wrote, journalists regularly engage in receiving classified information, asking for sources for more information, and publishing certain types of classified information. Criminalizing these activities would have a profound effect on the U.S. and international reporting. Yet, despite the implications of the Assange case for investigative journalism, there remains a distinct level of apathy on the part of not only the general public, but also, and more problematically, journalists. A large part of this undoubtedly has to do with what happened with both Assange and WikiLeaks after the 2010-11 release of material on Iraq and Afghanistan, leaked by whistleblower Chelsea Manning. The rape allegations in Sweden against Assange, his seeking refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, and the increasingly erratic and occasionally irresponsible flow of information coming from Assange and WikiLeaks both eroded support and caused many to forget just how important and radical WikiLeaks had been during their early years. This amnesia includes journalists and news organizations with whom Assange always had a tense relationship. Yet, many of those journalists and news organizations would do well to remember the huge volume of stories written on the back of material obtained through WikiLeaks in 2010 and 2011. material for which Assange now faces the possibility of life in prison for releasing, and for which Chelsea Manning has already spent time in prison, including solitary confinement. And the question, but is Assange a journalist? I would respond, as I have in the past, one expert said, Assange was a key part in the journalistic process, and by criminalizing his participation, you thereby criminalize that process. The use of power, be it military, economic, political, or social, demands monitoring through investigative reporting. Political and legal attacks that make such reporting more difficult or even criminal serve only the interests of the powerful the world over, be they in Tokyo, Washington, or Stockholm. The undermining of the free press is often the result of a slow legal erosion rather than dramatic earthquakes. And let's not be naive about the symbolic importance of the US putting Assange on trial. It would be an alibi for cracking down on journalism for every repressive authoritarian government in the world. And let's not be self-righteous or ethnocentric. It would also be an alibi for cracking down on journalism in countries that consider themselves to be free and democratic, including in the US or in Europe. The Assange case still matters a lot.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, dini, wal-azam ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about the rules of Hajj, in fact, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, as always, our guest speaker in the studio. Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about, the rules of Hajj Tamattu, and more in particular, we were talking about, we started, in fact, our episode from the last, your previous episode onward, about the prohibitions of Ihram. Let's continue some of these, prohibitions or those things which are not allowed for any pilgrims to Mecca. Would you?
Yes, sure. We have already discussed some of the prohibitions, and of course, the one of the things which is prohibited for a pilgrim is, especially for women, is to apply collyrium, which is called surma. Okay, it's not permissible for a woman or for a man to apply collyrium or surma.
Yes.
For example, men, women tend to wear makeup and wear, collyrium, mascara, and different things. Yeah. And they might want to apply lotion or things like that, which is not permissible, of course. Yes, if you want to apply sunscreen, it does not have fragrance. There's mm-hmm. no objection because you want to protect your skin. Okay,
right.
That's okay because in the hot season you can do that.
But what about some of the ointment for medical purposes?
That's also permissible mm-hmm. if there's ointment, and of course you want to apply it. There is no objection to you in doing so. Then we have looking in mirror. Okay, in a mirror you. There are mirrors here and there, especially when you want to enter a hotel or a restaurant, and there are mirrors in front of you. And these rules are applicable to, Shia Muslims. Sunnis might not have these restrictions, okay?
Right.
So they might want to look into mirrors. That is what we need to know. And we as Shia Muslims need to follow the religious authorities we have. And of course, in this program, we are discussing the rules according mm-hmm. to the fatwa or the verdicts of His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei. So looking in a mirror is not permissible. And if a person happens to look in a mirror, he has to pay the penalty or the kafara. Then we have wearing shoes. Wearing shoes is not permissible for men.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there are special slippers or flip-flops which a man should wear. So the upper part of the shoes and the feet must not be covered. You cannot wear socks. You must wear special flip-flops, and in order to avoid covering your feet. So, yeah,
but these shoes, most of these shoes are sewn.
No,
you know?
That's not called clothing. You know, it is, of course. You need to wear something. Footwear is necessary. You can walk barefooted, but if you want to wear something, you should wear something which does not cover your feet.
Uh-huh.
Okay, the upper part of your, or the upper sole of your foot.
Yeah, the sole. Yeah.
The sole should not be covered.
I see.
Then lying is absolutely forbidden. It's always forbidden, but lying, especially in the for a pilgrim, is absolutely forbidden. Quarreling is forbidden. No one has a right to quarrel with other pilgrims while performing Hajj, because it is a season. It is an occasion for reuniting, for showing
for peace and prosperity.
And
yes.
Prosperity, sure. So quarreling is forbidden. Killing lice or other, you know, insects found on the humans. Okay, if you find any insects on uh-huh. your body, walking, like for example, if there are cockroaches, or if there are lice, or if there are insects, flies. Okay,
mosquitoes, yeah. Flies. Yeah,
yeah. You cannot kill them. You should just simply push them aside.
Okay, drive them away.
Yeah, and killing insects, animals will make atonement obligatory.
I see.
And then beautifying oneself. Okay, I did say that wearing makeup is not permissible. Beautifying oneself, wearing jewelry, wearing adornments or things like that is absolutely forbidden, and okay. No one can do it.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take another break or a short break here. And we'll be back and continue our program, some of these rules regarding the prohibitions of Ihram here on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We are talking about the rules of prohibitions of Ihram according to Ayatollah Khamenei with Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, you were talking about those rules. If there are anything left, I'd appreciate you actually to shed some light on it.
Sure. One of the prohibitions of Ihram is to apply oil, okay. There are many pilgrims, especially Indians and Pakistanis, who are very much in the habit of applying oil, and necessary or unnecessary, they do it.
What is it for?
They apply oil to their hair, you know, to keep the to keep their hair tidy, or to keep their hair strong. And of course, applying oil has its fragrance as well.
Uh-huh.
So it's not permissible to apply oil. Oil is a term that can refer to many different things. Lotion is also included. For example, lotion is also a kind of liquid that's applied mm-hmm. to the body. So,
but what about moisturizing, for example, the skin?
If it's not necessary, it's not permissible to of course, to use moisturizers.
Except for some medical purposes,
yeah,
right?
If
you have a condition, medically
necessary,
speaking.
Unless necessary, one should not apply
right.
such things. Then we have removing hair from the body. It's not permissible to pluck your hair. Ladies cannot pluck their eyebrows or pluck their hair unless the hair falls off itself by itself. Right. It's not permissible for a person, man or woman, to remove his or her hair, because you will have to wait. If you are performing Umrah, you will have to wait until you are supposed to perform Taqsir. Taqsir is when you have completed the Sa'i and you have performed the Tawaf, and then after Tawaf you will perform Taqsir. Taqsir means that you cut short your hair or your nail. That's when you are allowed to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, then we have Halq. Halq also means to shave, okay? Shaving is the last practice before the Tawaf al-Nisa. Of course, you are supposed to perform Halq, which means that you will clean shave, or you will shave your hair, and that is when you are allowed to do so. Otherwise, before you complete the Hajj rituals, you are not allowed to pluck your hair. Then we have covering the head by males, or driving, diving in water, even by females, you know. So to understand the rules better, I want to say that there are some, you know, the weather is hot there. Many people might want to take an umbrella, you know, and walk and use the umbrella to cover themselves and to walk under the shadow. Walking under the shadow is not permissible for a person who moves from the station, from Miqat, towards Mecca. Of course, once you arrive in Mecca, this restriction is removed. Okay,
right.
Because while you are walking in the streets of Mecca, okay, shadow is there. You'll walk into the hotel, but as long as you have not reached there, you cannot walk.
Use an umbrella, you mean?
You cannot use an umbrella. You cannot cover your head. You cannot wear a hat or something, or a cap to cover your head.
Even so, despite the fact that some of these, time frames, I'm talking about the Zilhijjah time or month, which fall into the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes really extremely hot. In Saudi Arabia. So
there are two things. Of course, the weather is hot there, but we need to distinguish between covering the head and walking under the shadow. These are two different things.
Uh-huh.
Okay, sometimes there are elderly people, they always cover their head even if they are not performing Hajj. So covering the head is not permissible. It is necessary to remove the cap, to take it off and walk without wearing anything. Okay,
I see.
But walking under the shadow, it's not permissible, and regardless of whether you are a man or a woman, okay. Covering the head for ladies is a must. It is obligatory. They should cover their head and hair and neck and everything,
mm-hmm.
except for their faces,
right.
and hands up to the wrist. So as for walking under the shadow is concerned, of course, they cannot walk under the shadow whilst they are wearing ihram and moving towards Mecca.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice elaboration and shedding light on the rules about the prohibitions of ihram here in the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahman Rahim Mannan Kareem Salam Aleem Malja Ilaha Illa Hum Ghaffar Jameel Wahhab Latif Tawwab Samee Basir La Ilaha Illa Hum وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.